And he's going to explain the title, I guess, first.
Well, first of all, are the slides up or not? Because I'm checking on the website and I don't see them up.
We can't hear you. Can you hold the mic closer to you where you speak?
Yeah. So do you all have copies of the slides?
Yes, but I think some people here wanted to know what it means to what Probansky's, the word Probansky sectors means. So please explain it as you go along. Thank you.
Yeah, of course I will. Second. I need to get the slides up for myself.
Hello?
Hello, this is Perimeter.
Hi.
We're just trying to get the slides up here in Boca. We're just having some technical problems, but it'll just be a second. Okay, so I'm ready. So shall I start?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. So thanks for the opportunity to give this talk. So Probansky sectors of the new spinful model. So, I mean, unfortunately, the term Probansky sector is technical. This is always difficult to explain what this is without getting into technical details, because by its very nature, it's something technical. But basically, in spin foams, we're constructing a quantum dynamics for we're constructing a dynamics for loop quantum gravity. By first starting from quantum BF theory and then imposing simplicity constraints. And this idea of starting from a simpler topological field theory with no local degrees of freedom and then getting gravity by imposing constraints, this idea goes back to Probansky. And the issue is that once you impose the constraints, you have more than just the gravitational sector. You have other sectors. And that's what the term Probansky sector refers to. And these sectors, we haven't really paid much attention to the presence of these different sectors in spinful models in the past. And that's the main focus of this talk, is to focus on these sectors. So just to give some background, give a larger picture, spin foams, at least when Carlo and Michael Reisenberger started out looking for spin foam. When they originally proposed the idea of spin foam models, their idea was to define a path integral dynamics for loop quantum gravity. And for a long time, for a decade or so, there was one very commonly used spin foam model, and that's the Barrett-Crain model. And then in 2007, basically, through discovery of a reformulation of the simplicity constraint, paths were opened to define different spinful models. In particular, there's the EPRL model, which was introduced by myself, Roberto Pereira, Carlo Rovelli, and Atero Levine. And the exciting thing about the EPRL model is that once we imposed the simplicity constraints, we got quantum mechanical states which were an isomorphism with loop quantum gravity space. This was what was so exciting about it. The other models, for example, was the major one that people talked about and still talk about it, is the Friedel-Krasnov model, which used a different approach to imposing second-class constraints using coherent states. And for Barbara-Mercy parameter less than one, it's equal to the EPRL model. However, for gamma greater than one, the states which you're summing over is a larger state space than that which is present in loop quantum gravity. More recently, there was another model introduced by Muchin Han and Thomas Simon using commuting B fields. And it seems that for all gamma, you get a state space which is larger than loop quantum gravity. So I just wanted to mention the different spinful models that have been introduced based on these linear simplicity constraints. Because throughout most of this talk, we're going to be focusing on the implications of the linear simplicity constraints. And because all of these models use the linear simplicity constraints, what I'm going to talk about is relevant for them all. And the other thing I want to emphasize is that the main interest that I have in the EPRL model, and I will talk more specifically about the EPRL model in the second half of the talk, the interest is coming from the fact that you can actually use it to define spinform dynamics for loop quantum gravity. You have this convergence between a path integral approach to gravity and a canonical approach to gravity. Now, I will define the linear simplicity constraints later on. In fact, it'll be a little bit into the talk before I really say what they are. Next slide, slide three. So as I was saying before, spinform models are arrived at by the Plobansky formulation of gravity, where we start from a topological field theory, BF theory, and we impose simplicity constraints to get gravity. The BF action is given there. I've introduced the 1 over gamma star B term just to make it easy to relate it to the Holst action, which is loop quantum gravity. The Plobansky constraint is given there in the second line, and the solutions to the Plobansky constraint separate into 5 different sectors, and these are the Plobansky sectors. So in the first 4 sectors, 1 plus minus and 2 plus minus, there exists some tetrad, or cotetrad, such that B takes one of these 4 forms. And in the last sector, the degenerate sector, there exists no tetrad taking any of the earlier 4 forms. And it's only in sector 2 plus that the BF action reduces to the Holst action of gravity. And it's the Holst action of gravity which is the starting point for loop quantum gravity. The next slide, slide 4. So what we will show is that linear simplicity imposes restriction to sectors 2 plus, 2 minus, and the degenerate sector. So when you solve linear simplicity, you could be in any one of these 3 sectors. So from this perspective, it's better than the original SO4 Plobansky constraint, but you still have more than the usual GR sector. You also have the 2 minus and the degenerate sector. Now, there's always some awareness that you had these different sectors. You can see it implicitly in the literature, but it was never really focused on, and it was never really made precise. The main reason why it wasn't made precise is that there's a tension involved, because in spin foams, your basic variables are discrete, and the definition of the Plobansky sectors really happens in the continuum. I think the closest thing I saw in the literature, which really makes it precise, that linear simplicity imposes that you're in one of these 3 Plobansky sectors is in Florian Conradi and Laurent Friedel's paper on the semi-classical limit of 4D spinful models. They have a very nice appendix there where they derive the consequences of linear simplicity, and they show that you get a discrete analog of 2 plus and 2 minus. But it's still a discrete analog, so there's still a gap, and the first third of this talk will involve bridging this gap, just so that we can make this statement very clear and very certain that the linear simplicity constraint implies that you're in one of these three sectors. So the second third of the talk will focus on the asymptotics of the EPRL model, which were calculated by the Nottingham group, John Barrett and his collaborators. The equation that I show there is the asymptotics in only one of the sectors. And you have, even in this one sector, you have four different terms, and it's really only the first term that you want. Because when you're doing a path integral, you want the argument of the path integral to be e to the I action, classical action. So you really only want the first term. So the question is, where are the other terms coming from and what is their meaning? And so the second thing that we're going to show or review is that the extra terms are caused precisely by the other sectors, by the non-2 plus sectors, which are allowed by linear simplicity. And so the conclusion then is that the reason why you don't have the right semi-classical limit of the vertex amplitude is because the simplicity constraints are too weak. We're still including too many sectors. We're not restricting to only the GR sector, and that's the reason for the wrong semi-classical limit. And then the last part of the talk. So I'm on slide 6. I will show how to modify the EPRL vertex amplitude to restrict only to the 2 plus sector. So this is based on a paper which was just published on the archive today. I actually submitted it on Friday, but it only showed up today. And the resulting vertex amplitude still has all of the properties that we like about the EPRL vertex amplitude. You still have loop quantum gravity states on the boundary. The vertex amplitude is still linear in the boundary state, which is necessary to interpret it as a transition amplitude. And it's SU2 invariant. Plus, we only have a single term in the asymptotic, e to the I gravitational action. And all of the degenerate configurations are exponentially suppressed. For a while, people were concerned that maybe degenerate configurations would actually dominate the path integral. But if you modify the vertex in this way, and you really restrict yourself to the general relativity sector, then you don't have to worry about these degenerate configurations anymore, because they are exponentially suppressed. So, is everything fine so far? I just want to get some feedback to make sure you're still there. Are you there?
Yeah, go ahead.
Everything is great. Please go ahead.
Okay, great. So, the first section. So, we're going to define what we mean by Polonsky sectors for the discrete variables, resolving this tension between discrete and continuum that I mentioned earlier. So, so we're going to look at a single four simplex for simplicity. And number the tetrahedra 0 to 4, so each 4 simplex has 5 tetrahedra. And we label the triangles in the 4 simplex by the tetrahedra that are on either side of the triangle. So triangles are labeled by pairs of numbers. And if I want to care about the order of the pair, then this is determining the orientation of the triangle. So when I order the indices AB, that means I'm looking at the triangle AB seen as part of the boundary of tetrahedron A. And if I order it BA, then it's the triangle, the same triangle, viewed as the boundary of tetrahedron B. And these two triangles are the same triangle, just with opposite orientation. And with this definition, we can introduce the discrete variables. In order to do this, we think of the tetrahedron, each tetrahedron is having its own frame, and the four simplex is having its own frame. And what we have is we have a parallel transport from each tetrahedron to the four simplex frame. And this is an element of spin 4, the double cover of SO4. In the second line is a typo. I shouldn't have said SO13. I should have said SO4. In the second line, in the definition of the variables, we have a Lie algebra element in SO4 for each triangle AB, which is interpreted as the integral over that triangle of the two form B in the continuum theory. Those algebra elements, or bivectors, as shorter to call them bivectors, they're in the frame of the A tetrahedron. And using the parallel transports, we can parallel transport them all to the single simplex, four simplex frame. And this will be necessary in order to reconstruct the continuum B field. We need to bring all of the algebra elements into the same frame. One remark, the reason why you have the structure of the discrete variables is it's really coming from quantum BF theory. In quantum BF theory, you have a spinfold model, and these variables are what's naturally suggested. In this first, now we have some constraints on these variables. The first one is simply saying that when I look at self-dual and anti-self-dual parts of the algebra elements corresponding to a triangle in either frame A or B, that the magnitudes of these self-dual and anti-self-dual parts should be equal. Yeah, now I'm on page 9, next page. We have some further constraints. We have the orientation constraint. So this orientation constraint should be evaluated in a single frame, so I should really put a parenthesis S after both of those B fields. So when you transport the algebra elements to the same frame, then obviously the algebra elements corresponding to the same triangle, but as viewed from different tetrahedra, will be equal with opposite signs because they physically correspond to integrals, which are the same integral, you're just flipping the orientation. Then you also have closure. And the reason for the closure is basically because we're going to be reconstructing the continuum B field as a constant field in the four simplex. And you can see that just this little equation I have in the box, that when I sum over all of the algebra elements, all of the four algebra elements for a single tetrahedron, I have to get zero. Stokes theorem. And these conditions, I call them consistency conditions because they are what are necessary in order for there to exist a constant continuum B field corresponding to these bivectors. And so I define a set of bivectors satisfying these constraints. I define it to be a discrete Poblonsky field. I'm calling the B field B field the Poblonsky field, just to give it a name. And when I have bivectors which satisfy these constraints, this is like a discrete version of that.
Sorry, Jonathan, is there an easy way of seeing that? That is, that these constraints imply the existence of the continuum field?
Yeah, I'm going to come to that in a couple of slides.
Thanks.
So in order to answer your question, let me introduce some notations. Let's let M be R4 as an oriented affine manifold. So the only structure which I'm taking from R4 is basically the orientation and the flat connection. I'm not going to use any other structure from R4 here in the construction which I'm going to do now. The connection defines for us notions of straight lines, and it also lets us identify the tangent space at all points in the manifold, and it also allows us to identify the tangent space at any one point with the space of constant vector fields, and the same is true for tensors. So because of that, when I talk about vectors and tensors, I don't have to worry about in what tangent space they're living. So, another definition. A geometrical four simplex is just a four simplex in this on this manifold R4 of in the standard sense. I'm on slide 10. Next slide. So it's just it's the convex hull of 5 points in the manifold, not all of which lie in the same 3 points. I should say, no, that's right, the same 3 points. So four simplex is it's like the four-dimensional analog of a tetrahedron. And this becomes an ordered four simplex when I assign a number to each of its 5 vertices, such that when I form these vectors, so the vector between vertex 0,1, 0,2, 0,3, and 0,4, such that this has positive orientation, the positively oriented basis. I simply, this condition is simply in order to have some notion of orientation for the four simplex. And then each tetrahedron has only 4 vertices, and so it's missing exactly 1 vertex, and we label the tetrahedron by the 1 vertex that it does not contain. So now, again, a tetrahedron are labeled numbers 0 to 4, just as before. And again, we define the oriented triangle AB like we did before. It's the triangle between tetrahedra A and B oriented as the bound as part of the boundary of A if it's AB, and as part of the boundary of B if it's BA. And you can explicitly write down the inverse volume defining this orientation just by the equation in the bottom box. But that equation is just saying what I just said in words. Triangle AB is oriented such that the boundary of tetrahedron A. So here's the lemma. This is answering Hori's question. So if I have a discrete Poblonsky field, so a set of bivectors satisfying these two constraints, closure and orientation, then in fact there exists a unique constant SO4 algebra value 2 form, again that's a typo there, such that the bivectors are integrals of this continuum 2 form over the triangle. And actually, basically the same theorem was, this lemma was proven earlier in a paper by John Barrett, Winston Fairbairn, and Frank Hellman in 2009. You can find a proof of it there. You can also find a proof of it in the first of the two papers cited on the first slide. But I'm just going to give a heuristic counting argument to give you a basic idea of why you should believe this is true. So each of these bivectors is a 4x4 skew matrix. So you have 6 variables. And furthermore, you have, because your orientation is, the orientation constraint is satisfied, you really only have 1 independent bivector per triangle. You have 10 triangles in the 4 simplex, so that makes 10 times 6 is 60 variables. And then you have the closure constraint. So a priori, you have 5 closure constraints, 1 for each tetrahedron. But in fact, 1 of them is not necessary. Only 4 of them are independent. And each of them has 6 components. So the number of independent components of the closure constraint is 4 times 6 is 24. And then, so then 60 minus 24 means you have 36 independent components for the bivectors when they're constrained. But if you look at the continuum 2 form, it also has 6 times 6 equals 36 6 components. Basically, the ij indices can take on 6 independent combinations, and the mu nu indices can take on 6 independent combinations because they're skew symmetric. So that's just a very simple heuristic argument of why you should expect this to be true. If you want a more precise proof, just look at the reference. The next slide, slide 12. So from this lemma, if I have a set of bivectors satisfying the closure and orientation, and if I have some geometrical four simplex sigma, an ordered geometrical four simplex, then this determines a unique continuum two form. And I call this the two form of the five vectors adapted to the four simplex, just to give it a name. Now we can make the connection between the discrete variables, the discrete bivectors, and these Klebanski sectors, which make sense in the continuum. So just to remind you of the different definitions of the Klebanski sectors, I write them there again. There's a condition on the continuum 2 form. And if the continuum 2 form determined by the bivectors is in one of these Klebanski sectors, we say that this set of bivectors is in that same Klebanski sector. So this gives us a precise notion of a set of discrete bivectors being in a Klebanski sector. Now, so far, this seems to be dependent on the choice of a geometrical four-simplex, an ordered geometrical four-simplex sigma. But in fact, you can prove that this notion of Klebanski sector is independent of the choice of ordered four-simplex. So if the bivectors are in a given Klebanski sector relative to one ordered four-simplex, it's in the same Klebanski sector relative to any other. So I can drop this. I can drop the qualification adapted to sigma. Next slide, slide 13. So I was planning to skip the proof, actually. Does anybody want me to go through the proof of this or not?
Why don't you skip it and we can come back at the end if we have time.
Okay, good. So I'll skip it. So this is just, so slide 14, I'm just repeating what I said. So now what we have is we have a notion of a discrete Klebanski field being in a given Klebanski sector, and this is independent of your reference force simplex use. So slide 15, now we're going to the next section where we're going to talk about the consequences of linear simplicity, which Klebanski sectors are included by linear simplicity. Slide 16, next slide. So now I'm in a position where I can define linear simplicity. So the basic idea is that when I look at the four triangles in each tetrahedron, they should all be orthogonal to the normal to the tetrahedron. The tetrahedron is a three-dimensional object. And so it has a normal in four dimensions, and this normal should be orthogonal to all of its triangles. Basically, that's the essence of the linear simplicity constraint. That's the geometrical intuition behind it. And mathematically, it translates to the condition that you see boxed above. So for each tetrahedron, we require that there exists a normal such that this normal is orthogonal to the dual of the bivectors associated to each of the triangles in that tetrahedron. This is a condition which we impose in the four-simplex frame. In the frame of each tetrahedron, we impose a gauge-fixed version of this, where n is replaced by a certain canonical n, which is just 1, 0, 0, 0. And in this, so in the tetrahedron frame, the linear simplicity reduces to this equation you see above the box on the bottom. And when you solve these linear simplicity constraints, you find that the solutions are parameterized by reduced boundary data. You have basically you have one A, what I'm calling AB, per triangle, and two N. So again, this is a typo. I put one N and two A's, but it should actually be one A and two N. And in terms of, so N is an SU2 algebra element, or a three vector, however you want to think about it. And I'm specifying the SO4 algebra element in terms of its anti-self-dual and self-dual parts there. That's what the pairing means. So that's the explicit solution to the linear simplicity constraint, parameterized just by this A and this unit vector N, or equivalently a unit SU2 algebra element per triangle. Next slide, slide 17. And then when we parallel transport this to the four simplex frame, we get the expression which is boxed here on slide 17. So the spin 4 group element G decomposes into anti-self-dual and self-dual parts. I'm denoting those X minus an X plus. So the anti-self-dual and self-dual parts just act on the anti-self-dual and self-dual parts of the phi vector. This triangle is the adjoint action. So this gives us a certain function of the group elements, the spin 4 elements, and these A's and these N's. And this function of these data I call B physical. Basically, the bi vectors are determined by this data in the four simplex frame. Now we can ask a question. These physical bivectors, what I'm calling physical bivectors, they, by construction, satisfy linear simplicity. And so now we can ask, what are the possible Poblonsky sectors that they're in? We've also made clear what it means for a set of bivectors to be in a certain Poblonsky sector. So now we can ask the question. So next slide, slide 18. So now the question is well defined. So we can first ask, does linear simplicity imply that these bivectors are in a Poblonsky sector? And second, which sectors does it isolate? And we will show that the answers are first, yes, it does imply that it's in a Poblonsky sector, and possible sectors are 2 plus, 2 minus, and the generate sector. Next slide, slide 19. So just a brief sketch of the proof. Can define these geometrical bivectors. This is from the paper by the Nottingham group on the asymptotic. So here, NA is the normal to the tetrahedron A, the outward pointing normal. And there's a lemma which improves that says that these geometrical bivectors are always in Poblonsky sector 2 plus. This is not immediately obvious because this is this expression is written in terms of the normals to the tetrahedra, whereas the definition of Poblonsky sector 2 plus is written in terms of tetrads, and it's not really obvious, but you can prove it. And second, if I have two sets of SU2 group elements, so each set consisting of five elements, and I say that they're equivalent, if there exists an SU2 group element Y and five signs, epsilon A, such that they're related by this equation, the definition of the bottom. So what's the relevance of this definition? Well, if the self-dual and anti-self-dual parts of my parallel transport are equivalent, then the corresponding physical bivectors in the degenerate sector. Next slide, slide 20. And now we use this reconstruction theorem, which was proven by the Nottingham group. And basically, I'm summarizing it here, that if linear simplicity is satisfied, and if A and N, the reduced boundary data, if they're non-degenerate and satisfying closure. So non-degenerate means that in each tetrahedron, the four N's are linearly independent. And if the group elements satisfy the orientation constraint, and if the self-dual and anti-self-dual parts of the group elements are not equivalent, then there exists an ordered geometrical four simplex such that the physical bivectors are equal to the geometrical bivectors, up to a sign mu, where this mu, the sign mu is independent of any ambiguity in the choice of the force input. So from the above results, you can just piece them together very, very quickly, and what you get is that if you have reduced boundary data, which is non-degenerate, so the ends are in each tetrahedron are linearly independent, and if you satisfy closure and orientation, then if the anti-self-dual and self-dual group elements are not equivalent, then the physical bivectors are in sectors 2 plus or 2 minus, depending on the sign of mu. And if they are equivalent, then they're in the degenerate sector. Just trivial piecing together of the lemmas already quoted. Next slide, 21. This is just a summary of what I just said. So there's the conditions listed on the left there, which then lead to the conclusion that you're in one of these three sectors. And now I just want to say where these things are imposed in the E-parallel vertex. So actually, tetrahedron non-degeneracy is not imposed in the E-parallel vertex. I'll make a remark on this at the bottom of the slide. Exposure and orientation are basically imposed by the asymptotics of the vertex, we'll see. And then, of course, linear simplicity is imposed directly on the variables. Now, to get a cleaner result, I would like to be able to prove that the tetrahedron degeneracy, so that if not all of the ends in a given tetrahedron are linearly independent, then this implies that you're in the degenerate Poblansky sector. This is probably easy to prove. I only realized that you could make it cleaner by proving this. I realized this when I was preparing the talk, and I just didn't get around to trying to prove it. But if you prove this, then you have a much simpler statement, which is basically that closure, orientation, and linear simplicity imply that you are in 2 plus, 2 minus, or the degenerate sector. So next slide, slide 22. So now we come to the interpretation of the E parallel vertex amplitude in terms of these sectors. Slide 23. So on the boundary of the fourth simplex for this vertex amplitude, we have an SU2 spin network. So far I've just been talking in terms of triangulation. So on the boundary of the fourth simplex, we have tetrahedra, the triangulation of basically a three-sphere from the tetrahedra. And dual to this triangulation, you have a graph. So each triangle, you see this little picture at the bottom of slide 23, each triangle is dual to a link in the graph, and each tetrahedron is dual to a node. So you have a graph on the boundary, and that makes the connection with loop quantum gravity spin network states, which are based on graphs. You remember that we have in loop quantum gravity, we have on the spin network, we have a spin associated to each edge, and so now these edges, these links are dual to triangles, so now we have spins associated to triangles. And usually people talk in terms of intertwiners at the node, but it's going to be convenient for me to look at generalized spin networks, so I'm not going to impose gauge invariance. That allows me to talk about four states at each node. So now this becomes four states associated with psi AB, psi BA. These are living in irreducible representations of SU2. So for each triangle, just to summarize again, for each triangle we have a spin K, and we have two states now. What I call here psi AB and psi BA, and both of them are living in this representation KAB. Those are the labels for the spin network. And then you have an explicit expression here for the corresponding wave function. So the idea in defining the E-parallel vertex is first we embed this loop quantum gravity state into a spin 4 state. So we integrate it into a Hilbert space very similar to the loop quantum gravity Hilbert space, except instead of SU2, we have spin 4. At this point, I'm not going to give the detailed expression for that because it's not relevant for the following discussion. Next slide, slide 24. So then the expression for the vertex is just the one box above. Associated to the boundary state, I have an amplitude, a vertex amplitude, and it's basically just given by the embedding of psi, this spin network state. And so now this is a function of spin 4 group elements, and I'm just integrating over it in the way it's specified there. So I'm integrating over these g's. I have one g per tetrahedron, and these g's, again, have the interpretation of parallel transport from tetrahedra to the four simplex frame. And then these GABs are basically parallel transports between tetrahedra frames. And this can really be interpreted as a path integral. These G's have the meaning of the parallel transports, and this is like a path integral. And in fact, there are two ways to see this. If you derive the initial VF spin foam model that you start with, you integrate out the discretized connection. And if you keep this integration explicit, eventually it ends up in the inside of the vertex amplitude. You can really see this as this integration over the G's as some remnant from the integration over the discrete connection. And also when you look at the asymptotic analysis of the vertex amplitude, you see that these G's behave just like the parallel transport. So this interpretation is justified. Next slide, slide 25. The next thing important for the asymptotics is the definition of these Perelimov coherent states. They're labeled by a spin K and a unit three vector N. And the states live in the irreducible representation corresponding to spin K, and they are eigenstates of N dotted with the SU2 generator. And these are basically coherent states which are peaked on certain values of the SU2 generator. And using such coherent states, you can construct coherent boundary states. Basically, I choose these states psi to be Perelimov coherent states. And these coherent states are labeled by k's and n's. And in fact, these coherent boundary states are they're just the quantum analog of the classical reduced boundary data in which A is just k times a certain prefactor, 8 pi g times the Barbara-Murphy parameter, and n. So this is exactly corresponding to a particular choice of classical reduced boundary data. And there's an overall phase ambiguity in the definition of these coherent states because the Perelimov coherent states are defined via an eigenvalue equation, so they have phase ambiguity. Next slide, slide 26. So now we define the notion of Regé-like boundary data. First of all, you impose the notion of Regé-like boundary data includes tetrahedron non-degeneracy, so the ends are non-degenerate. Closure. So I originally defined closure in terms of the B field. When you write it in terms of the reduced boundary data, it's just just take the area of the A for a given triangle times the N for that triangle, and then you sum over all of the triangles in a tetrahedron, and then it's zero. That's the closure in terms of A's and N's. And when those two conditions are satisfied, you have a uniquely determined tetrahedron geometry. Then you have basically five tetrahedra geometries. And then you can ask the question, do these tetrahedra geometries fit together? And if they fit together, then we say that it satisfies the gluing constraint. And if all of these things are satisfied, we say that this data is Regé-like. And when we have Regé-like boundary data, then this phase ambiguity that I mentioned on the other page can be resolved, and you have what's called the Regé state on the boundary corresponding to this boundary data. Then you have the, you also need to define a vector geometry. A vector geometry, it's basically like a Regé-like geometry, just dropping the tetrahedron non-degeneracy condition. That's a very rough statement, but you can make it precise, and it's a little bit more complicated to make it precise, but that's what it is. You're just dropping the tetrahedron non-degeneracy. Next slide, slide 27. So the strategy that the Nottingham group takes is they take seriously this expression for the vertex as a path integral over parallel transport G, and they just use stationary phase, generalized stationary phase method. So you get critical points. The critical points are stationary points of the action, and they're points where the real part of the action is maximal. And you get two critical points equations. First, closure. This is the closure constraint I was mentioning earlier in terms of k's and n's. This is a condition on the boundary data, so it's really a condition for there to exist stationary points or a critical point. And then the other condition is the orientation constraint. The orientation constraint is really showing that these x's, recall that x plus and x minus are the self-dual and anti-self-dual part of G. So this is really showing that the group elements are acting like the parallel transport. Next slide, 28. And now we can state the theorem, the asymptotic theorem proven by the Nottingham group. So basically, if you have boundary data which is Regé-like, then you have these four terms. You have the e to the I Regé action, e to the minus I Regé action, and then you have these two funny terms. And if it's not Regé-like, but it's a vector geometry, you still get a critical point, but you don't have the asymptotics are non-oscillatory. It's just it's just what you see in equation 2 there. And then if B is not even a vector geometry, then it decays, then the amplitude decays exponentially, lambda. So what I'm doing is I'm starting with boundary data and I'm scaling the spins k uniformly by some coefficient lambda. And the limit as lambda goes to infinity, I get these asymptotic formulas. And it's the first term in equation one that we really want. Next slide, slide 29. Now each term in these asymptotics corresponds to a critical point in the G integral, and so therefore it corresponds to a particular values of the G's. So now we can ask a question. For each of these terms in the asymptotics, we can ask, what does the corresponding physical bivector, in what Polonsky sector is the corresponding physical bivector? Because each term in the asymptotics corresponds to a value of the G's and therefore a value of the physical bivector. And if we go back to slide 28, the first term in equation 1 corresponds to 2 plus, the second term corresponds to 2 minus, and all of the other terms correspond to the degenerate sector. So the one term that we want turns out to correspond precisely to the general relativity sector. So go back to slide 29 and then go on to slide 30. Let me emphasize again that then the conclusion of this is the reason for the non-GR terms in the asymptotics is because linear simplicity is too weak, because it is not isolating the GR sector, which is 2 plus. So now let me finish with the last section, which has to do with modifying the E-parallel vertex amplitude, calling this the proper E-parallel vertex amplitude. Slide 31, the next one. So the key to modifying the E-parallel vertex amplitude is to try to find an explicit expression which will isolate the 2 plus sector. This is actually rather tricky to do. The key to it was that I found an explicit expression for the geometrical bivectors in this top boxed equation. That should not be phys on the left-hand side. That should be geom. But you have an explicit expression for the geometrical bivectors. When you have the parallel transports G acting on this canonical vector N, when GA acting on N, this gives you the normal to the eighth tetrahedron up to a sine. And the whole difficulty is figuring out what the overall sine should be for the geometrical bivector, because it's all about the sine when you're trying to restrict to the 2 plus sector. And it turned out that the trick which helped me to figure out how to fix the sign is that the geometrical bivectors satisfy the a four-dimensional closure constraint. If you look at the equation on the bottom right-hand corner, this gives you a four-dimensional analog to closure. When I take the normals to the tetrahedra and multiply them by the volumes of the tetrahedra and sum over them, I get zero. And this is enough to fix the sign.
This is a question of precision. Can you say what you mean by GAB? Because so far you have defined only GA.
Oh, I'm sorry. GAB is the parallel transport from tetrahedron B to tetrahedron A. So it's just equal to GA inverse times GB. I said it briefly, but not very, I didn't really emphasize it. So the explicit expression for the sine factor is given in the second box. Here the notation, when I have a big G acting on canonical vector N and then I have a little I, this simply means I'm acting with the SO4 action of the spin 4 element on the 4 vector N, which gives me a 4 vector, and then I'm just projecting it into the spatial part. So you have this expression, and that gives you exactly the right sine factor. Where CDE here is basically equal to the numbers other than AB. So there's 5 tetrahedra total, and so it's labeling the other tetrahedra besides AB. And it doesn't matter the order that C, D, and E are in. You get the same sign. And just by convention, I let sine of 0 be 0. And this expression G dot curly N with little I has a more explicit expression, which I like to use, which is a trace of tau I times is XAB minus XBA plus. So using self-dual and anti-self-dual parts of the parallel transport. You can get a more explicit expression. But this tau I's are the normalized poly matrix at the bottom. Next slide, slide 32. There's a computer problem again here. I'm going to use my paper slide. Okay, so slide 32. So now, if you recall, mu is determining which sector we're in, if whether we're in 2 plus or 2 minus. And so if we look at the equation defining mu, it says b physical is equal to mu times b geometrical. Now we have explicit expressions for all everything except for mu here, and so we can solve this for mu. And we get an explicit expression for mu. The expression only matters up to a positive constant, and you see it reduces to the expression you see there in the second equation. So therefore, the condition to isolate 2 plus is precisely the inequality that you see boxed in the green box. And because this is, I'm requiring this to be strictly greater than 0, this is also sufficient to impose non-degeneracy. This is also sufficient to impose non-degeneracy. So this is really isolating the 2 plus sector. What we're going to do is we're going to quantize this condition and insert it into the vertex amplitude and get a new vertex amplitude. So next slide, slide 32. I mean 33. In order to quantize it, it's convenient to rewrite it in terms of the spatial rotation generators. Maybe I don't review these equations. So basically, except for the second to last one, the spatial rotation generators are just equal to k times n. And this k is a positive factor, so I can just replace n with l, the spatial rotation generator. So you get this equation at the bottom of slide 33. Next slide. So now, let's get more explicit with the EPRL vertex. Actually, we're running out of time, so let me just go to the box equation. This gives an explicit expression for the embedding I of an SU2 spin network. The key thing to note here is that when these spatial rotation generators act on I psi, in the last two equations, what this is saying is that they're basically just acting via the SU2 generators on the vectors psi AB and psi BA. That's all they do.
So is this just EPRL, or have you changed anything? And if you just tell us when you change, because not all of us are familiar with the notation.
Yeah, okay. So this is still EPRL. Nothing has changed. Yeah, this is the embedding from SU2 states to spin 4 states, and showing the action of these rotation generators.
Okay, thank you.
So LABI just acts in acts on psi AB, and LBAI acts on psi BA, the vectors in these irreducible representations. Next slide, slide 35. So then putting this together, you have the original vertex expression, so just taking the embedded SU2 spin network and integrating over the G's like we had before, you get the expression for the vertex. And as I was saying before, this integral over the G's should be interpreted as a path integral over the parallel transport. So now what we want to do is we want to impose this restriction to 2 plus. And this was an inequality, and so what one would like to do is basically insert a heavy side theta function to impose this inequality. It's the one that you see on the slide there. One problem with this is that you don't have any classical LABI appearing in this path integral. Instead, what you have are these psi ABs living in irreducible representations of the rotation generator. So what we need to do is we need to quantize at least the L part of this expression. And the reason for this sort of strange hybrid quantization where we're just quantizing L is basically because the path integral we're dealing with has a sort of hybrid status. The G's are classical, and the momenta are being represented by these by these vectors psi in the irreducible representation. So they're being represented quantum mechanically. So I have to do a sort of partial quantization of this theta factor, which I'm going to insert. And as I was saying, that the LABIs, they act just through the SU2 generators on the psi ABs. So we just quantize them as the SU2 generators. And then so the quantization of this theta factor is just the projector you see at the bottom. And this P0 infinity is just the spectral projector onto the positive spectrum of its argument. This is the quantization of the Heaviside theta function, in a sense. Next slide, slide 36.
So just a second. So going back to 35, just the first comment I just wanted to make was that this hybrid thing is not, it's a natural thing, right? Because you are integrating over quantum geometries rather than classical geometries. And therefore, you have got these quantum numbers associated with geometries coming in.
Okay.
And therefore, your quantization of Li is also natural because it is associated with those quantum geometries one is integrating over. Right? There's nothing so unnatural about it, I think. So am I wrong about this?
I think you're right. It is natural. It's just you don't see this very often.
Okay. The second thing is that, I mean, you wrote down this operator and you said this, you know, you look at the projector on zero infinity. What do we know about this operator? I mean, it's a self-adjoint operator. It has a spectrum which is continuous, discrete, or?
Oh, sure, of course. I mean, it's a projection operator. It's an orthogonal projection operator on a finite dimensional Hilbert space. It's a projector onto the irreducible representation of SU2,
okay.
Labeled by the spin associated with triangle AB.
Okay.
So it's just an orthogonal projection in a finite dimensional Hilbert space. So the spectrum is equal to 0 and 1.
But then 0 is excluded somehow, is that right? I'm trying to understand that
zero,
because if you write theta function, it is ambiguous as to what is happening to to 0.
Oh, so you're right. Thank you very much. You're absolutely right. So in order for this, for the bottom expression to really be a quantization of this theta function, then the theta function really needs to be interpreted as being 1 only when the argument is strictly positive.
Thank you.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And I'm doing this deliberately in order to exclude the degenerate sector.
All right.
Next slide, slide 36. So when you insert this, so now we have this projector that we can insert into the expression for the vertex. So we have these one factor for each triangle in the vertex, and we can just stick it in there, acting on psi BA. Now, one remark is that I've inserted this projector on the right-hand side of each of these factors. I call these factors space factors. But I could also put it on the left on psi AB. It doesn't matter. You get it's equal. You can show that they're equivalent. You can move the projector around in this expression using the covariance of the structures involved. So once we define it in this way, we can look at the properties. So you still have SU2 spin network data on the boundary. So you can still use this to define a spin foam dynamics for loop quantum gravity. It is still linear in the boundary state. And this is important because you want your final transition amplitude to be linear in the initial state and antilinear in the final state. Otherwise, it's not really a transition amplitude. And it's SU2 gauge invariant. These things were also satisfied by the EPRL vertex amplitude. But in addition, in the asymptotics, we only have a single term, which is equal to e to the I reg action. And all degenerate configurations are exponentially suppressed. And this is something you have to prove. From this whole talk, it's reasonable that you should expect this, but actually proving this is non-trivial. But this is what you find. You find you only get the one desired term. You can look at the paper, which is on the archive now, for the proof of that. So, slide 37. So, just the final message. We defined a continuum 2 form associated to the discrete bivectors just by making the usual heuristic prescription precise. That the bivectors should just be integrals of the continuum 2 form. And with this definition of the continuum 2 form, we have shown that linear simplicity allows Hobonsky sectors 2 plus 2 minus and the degenerate sector. And only 2 plus is the usual GR sector. And second, when you look at the asymptotics of the EPRL vertex, the configuration at the critical point for the one term that we really want corresponds precisely to the 2 plus. It's in the 2 plus sector. And all of the unwanted terms are in the 2 minus or degenerate sector. And so the conclusion is that the non-GR asymptotics of the EPRL vertex is due to linear simplicity being too weak, that it does not isolate the 1 2 plus sector. Next slide. And then finally, we show that by supplementing linear simplicity precisely by imposing the 2 plus sector, we obtain a new vertex amplitude that has all of the same desirable properties as the EPRL model. But also, we have the correct asymptotic, which is just the single exponential of I times the regex. Next slide, 39. Just some remarks on outlook. I think that the extension of this to the Lorentzian case should be straightforward. I don't see any reason why it should be difficult. But the generalization to a general four cell would be complicated. So the Minsky-Kieselowski-Lewandowski extension of spin foam to arbitrary cell complexes would be more tricky. Basically, because if you do this naive degree of freedom counting that I did earlier, it doesn't work anymore. You have too many bivectors in order to really determine the continuum 2 form. So it's not clear exactly what to do in that case. And also, in the definition of the proper vertex, the definition of the beta signs used in a key way that there are 5 tetrahedra per 4 simplex. Probably these things can be generalized to a general cell complex, to a general 4 cell, but it needs to be rethought deeply, I think. So I'll stop there. Thank you.
Questions?
I have a question. This is Laurent. Hi, John. I have a question concerning, did you look at what this positivity condition means on the SU2 boundary states, how it will translate? And I have another question within that question is that, it's written as a gauge invariant a quantity, so it should be gauge invariant, but since it's a positivity of an L generator, I'm wondering how it plays with the boundary gauge invariant of the SU2.
You're right, it's not obvious. I was actually surprised by the SU2 invariance of it, but it does work out. Let me see if I can summarize it. There's a covariance property for this projector. So are you concerned because when I act with the spin 4 element on this?
Let's focus on the first question first. What is the condition implies on the boundary state SU2?
So you mean that if you require this composition law to hold, that for example that you and Florian talked about in one of your papers in 2007 or 8 or so, if you require this composition law to hold, this more or less determines what boundary state you have. That's what you're talking about, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I don't know. That's a good question. I mean, naively, I would expect it to, again, be the usual SU2 spin network state, but it's a good question. And perhaps
there should be a restriction maybe on this SU2 spin network state because of the positivity condition of some operators, no? I don't know. I'm just asking.
It could be. It's quite possible. I don't know.
Okay.
What did you say, Laura? It should be SU2 gauge invariant, but just projected on some subspace. Is that what you're saying? Hello? Can you hear me?
We can.
Yeah,
we can.
Okay, so the question is, with this projector, do you get additional conditions on the allowed boundary states? And if so, is the condition just of the type that you have to project into some subspace?
Oh, so the question is directed to me. I don't know. It's difficult because this projector is not really acting in the loop quantum gravity boundary space. So because it's depending on these spin 4 group elements, the question, I'm not sure what the answer is. I'm not sure how to interpret the projector in such a way that that I can answer your question.
Okay, so let me just put it, ask this slightly different question. So if we ought to define this amplitude, right?
Yes.
You modified vertex amplitude.
Yes.
But then at the end of the day, are we performing integrals between arbitrary boundary spin networks, or are we restricting somehow the allowed boundary spin?
We're not restricting, not at all.
Okay. Okay. So the question is only of interpreting this,
yes,
and you are saying that, yeah, okay. I have a question for, I guess, the real experts, Laura and Carlo and people in Nottingham Group. I mean, to me, this seems fantastic. And am I missing something here, or are you as surprised as I am that, in fact, what seemed like a whole bunch of problems for a while are all completely solved? Or I think it will be good for you to comment, just for those of us who are not experts.
Okay. So maybe I can comment. I mean, personally, I'm not surprised, because with Florian, we suggested that, you know, you have to adapt. We suggested that you should exclude this degenerate configuration from the path integral to get the proper behavior all the time. What Jonathan has been doing here is identifying properly, you know, how it can be done with the sets of variable in the APRL. Which is very good.
Actually,
yeah, but the procedure seems surprisingly simple to me, and that is what surprised. I mean, I agree that your work suggested
a long time ago. Yeah, I mean, we emphasized that, but we emphasized that in the path integral, it's simple and yes and no, because it's not an easy. I mean, writing this theta function in terms, let's say, of spin variables, for instance, is going to be very challenging. So it's you know, it's simple once you have this proper variable where you could do that. But if you try to translate that in the usual old spin network type of variable, that's going to be extremely complicated condition. This condition that impose the conditions that somehow delta of G is strictly positive somewhere in the path integral, that drastically changed the asymptotics. Yeah, that has been, but it's, yeah, that has been proposed before. But it's not. It's simple because we write this path integral in terms of these coherent states, or you know, because you can write them down, but maybe John can comment on that.
Yeah, I wanted to comment on that. So actually, you're right. In your paper with Florian on the semi-classical limit of the FK model, you exclude the degenerate sector, but you also remark that one of the open problems is that you don't know how to do this in the spin form representation. And this does this. It allows you to exclude the degenerate sector while still working within the spin form representation. And that's actually important because it's in the spin form representation that you really have a firm connection with canonical loop quantum gravity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just a few weeks ago, we had Muxin Han visit here, and this question came up also in terms of, you know, the things that he's doing for asymptotics using the quantum groups. And at that time, for example, in our discussions, it looked like it was really very, very difficult to get rid of the undesirable sectors. And here, Jonathan is telling us, I mean, I agree with Laura that in terms of writing it in terms of, you know, actual spins and so on may be difficult, but conceptually, the structure seems rather simple and beautiful. And so can this, for example, be generalized for the quantum groups? Maybe Muxin has something to say.
I don't have anything to say. Maybe Muxin has something. I don't know. It's a good question. It would be very nice.
Yeah, apparently it would be difficult. I mean, you know, it's interesting, but it would be difficult because there's not yet a controlled a coherent state representation of the quantum groups, you know, in terms of these classical variables. So, but it might be able, you know. So it's really the implementation of these conditions really depends on the fact that you're able to write this amplitude in a certain form. But now that we have them, maybe, you know, John is going to study it and find another way to write it which is generalizable.
Or maybe one can relook at the quantum groups and see if one can formulate that in terms of these particular coherent states, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's a very good suggestion.
More questions?
Yeah, hi, this is Frank Hellman from Berlin. And I just wanted to make a few brief comments. The first one regarding the last slide, the generalization of KKL, I think this is going to be extremely challenging, actually, because the way that Jonathan excludes the degenerate sector relies very much on being able to characterize the geometric sector in a kind of in a natural way. And in order to get everything in a natural way, this is going to be extremely challenging for KKL because we don't even really know what the geometricity type conditions are. What there's a lot of things that can go wrong there in the generalized things that can't go wrong in the four simplex simply because the four simplex is so simple as a geometric object. So I think this is going to be extremely challenging, but also of course for that reason extremely interesting. A more direct way to do this that would work more straightforwardly in the KKL case as well would be to follow along the lines of what Bianca Dittrich and collaborators have proposed in terms of writing everything in terms of edge constraints rather than in terms of positivity constraints, which should have a similar effect. And I would be very curious to see whether something similar to like the prescription here could be used to implement their form of writing the constraints that reduce you to genuine geometric sectors in a spin form. That's a first comment. Second comment is that I wanted to ask specifically about the way the asymptotics are done. The space of degenerate solutions is five dimensions larger than the space of geometric solutions. So by taking it out, by cutting off just above zero, it looks like you might just get boundary effects. And once you get to this space might still show up in the asymptotics in some sense that you can't see here precisely because, because you're not integrating over the boundary degrees of freedom yet. Do you have an opinion on this?
So you mean, you think that there's some boundary effects because, well, I mean, you're integrating over the full group manifold.
I mean, not the group manifold. I mean, once I integrate over the B fields or the boundary states, the integration, and I don't cut out the diagonal or the degenerate sector. Then the integration will be peaked on a five-dimensional higher space in the degenerate sector compared to the geometric sector, 10 versus 15-dimensional sectors. So that's why we expect some of the degenerate sector to dominate. Now, if I don't quite understand this, if I would just cut this out. Like just cut out the five-dimensional sector, but run all the way up to it. It seems like that part could still dominate in the path integral afterwards.
I'm a little bit confused. So you're talking about integrals over B fields. Are you talking about a general triangulation?
Yeah. Once we put things together. I mean,
I see.
In some sense, as long as we're not putting things together in any way, like I can reduce to at least the 2+ and the 2- sector using Florian Conradi and Laurent Friedel's prescription of just eliminating the diagonal group elements from the group integration. But I would expect that I'm kind of running into problems then once I start putting things together, and the fact that I've just, you know, taken out a manifold that should classically dominate will still show up at the boundary. they've just taken out that manifold. So your prescription seems very kind of, this is about what happens with the Heaviside theta function at zero, basically. Is this strong enough to really take out, is this regular at this boundary in some sense, is the question.
Well, I'm so confused because you're talking about integrating over B fields. I guess you're talking about integrating over B fields in the interior of the triangulation. Is that what you mean? Like the quantum B fields?
Exactly. Exactly. I mean, this is how we derive our intuition for these things, right? We say we look at the asymptotics, and then we say, okay, so once I put these pieces together, I'm going to integrate over the leftover degrees of freedom in the B field, and these now look like geometric, like 2 plus, 2 minus, degenerate. Now you say, oh, I'm getting rid of 2 minus and degenerate, but the thing is degenerate is so much larger and lies right next to 2 plus and 2 minus that I'm wondering whether when you get rid of this, you might not get, you might not still see this afterwards, or whether the effect is somehow, whether you have an expectation for this. I mean, this is clearly something that we do not know how to treat technically, so I'm just asking about your intuition about this issue.
I'm still confused because, I mean, we don't restrict the sum. In this model, you don't restrict the sum over spins and intertwiners in any way. It's true that the non-Regi-like configurations are exponentially suppressed, but you're still summing over.
Right.
It's no sort of hard cutoff. I mean, the fact that you're using these projectors...
That doesn't just project out, like, doesn't that just set to zero a set of I mean, isn't that just a way of restricting the integration over the B field, or is this am I looking at this in the wrong way then?
No. It's enforcing a relation between the B field and the G field. Oh, it's, yeah.
Right, so...
But you're not restricting either one separately.
Okay, I need to think about that. Thank you.
I'd be interested in talking about this more with you, Frank.
Excuse me. This question concerns the fact that by restricting to the 2 plus vector, you're only getting e to the I regi action, and you don't get the 2 minus vector. Now, in the Ponsano regi model, for instance, you get 2 sectors. You get both the plus and the minus sector, and every kind of attempt that I've seen so far of reducing to the 1 or only to the plus sector severely cripples the model, and there's all kinds of good properties that you're somehow missing suddenly. So now, my question is somewhat twofold. On the one side, could you restrict only to the 2 plus and 2 minus sector in the EPIL model and only leave out the degenerate sectors? Or on the other side, would restricting the Ponsano regi model only to the e to the plus I regi action lead to a good way of cutting out all the negative volumes or the negative orientations?
So the question is about the Ponsano regi model.
Yes.
Right? Okay. So I'm not sure. The thing is that in the Ponsano regi model, you don't really have the simplicity constraint. All of it, the whole thing, is the gravitational sector. So I'm not sure if it's really the same thing. I mean, superficially, it seems like the same thing, but I'm not convinced it is because you don't have the analog of Polonsky sectors in the Ponsano regi model. I'd also be interested in getting references on what sort of problems arise in the Ponsano regi model when you try to remove one of these terms, just to see if something similar happens here.
Okay, so if I understand you correctly, the occurrence of the both signs in the exponent in the EPIL model on the one side, the Ponsano regi model on the other side, is something completely different, right?
I think so. I mean, that's my intuition.
Okay, thank you.
Since you're doing all this in the Riemannian signature, I mean, you know, in quantum field theory, there is a usual procedure as to what one should do in order to just look at the positive frequency sector, so to say.
and how it translates in Euclidean sector. And that heuristically does correspond to just looking at one orientation. And so it would be good to sort of tie together what you had done, rigorous results in quantum field theory, and slightly in between heuristic things that Teitelbaum was doing a while ago. I think that they're all closely related, and it will be a very fertile area to look at.
Thank you.
Okay, if there are no more questions, let's thank John again.
Right, thank you.